All right, welcome to the inaugural podcast here with SB Nation Arizona and Bright Side of the Sun collaborating to bring to you some Phoenix Suns action, the good, the bad, the ugly, and I mean, it's more or less one of those things, and you could figure it out if you've been watching the season so far. I'm Chris Habis, writer for SB Nation Arizona, covering the Suns inside and out for you guys all season on there. We now also have Jim Kokenauer on the line from Bright Side of the Sun. He's definitely the website's Mr. Brightside, as well known for his very pointed and very well articulated articles about the Suns, whether they're being good or bad. How are we doing tonight, Jim?
I'm doing good. I'm glad that we have a chance to work together on this. So, you know, hopefully we're going to make this a regular event for our readers and listeners. And, you know, hopefully everybody will be happy with the product. If they aren't, then we will gladly refund their money.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? And it's not even anything where you got to give us a reason why. If Jim drops the ball, if I drop the ball, if we find a way to get blown out by 40 on this podcast, don't give us a reason. Just give us a call. We'll hit up Jason Rawley, and we'll just go ahead and give you your money back for the podcast. And we'll touch on that a little bit later. We'll be a little tongue-in-cheek with that, but we'll touch about that a little bit later on in the podcast. And first thing I want to get started, you know, I want to hit on this immediately because it's one of the things we've talked about a ton, and it's something that the coaches have talked about in all their media sessions, practice, games, etc. The woeful perimeter defense. It's been bad. It's been bad for a lot of reasons. From your perspective watching the games, let's talk about the perimeter defense. I'll let you go ahead and bat first on that, and I'll jump in.
Okay. Yeah, the Suns, obviously, you know, if you want to look at the biggest, you know, salient reason that the Suns have gotten off to the tough start they have is absolutely the perimeter defense. They're allowing almost 44% from three-point range, and only two other teams in the last 14 years have surrendered over 40% from three. You know, their overall field goal percentage is also near the bottom of the league, and they're near the bottom of the league in almost any defensive metric you can think of. It's been atrocious, and it's really, you know, been the focal point of the team's failures so far this season.
Yeah, and like you said, from almost every metric, they're giving up 47% from the field. Their adjusted field goal percentage is almost at 52 defensively. I mean, that's pretty brutal. And to go in on the three-point shooting, I mean, their jump shots, they're giving up 67% of the points are coming from jump shots, and teams are shooting almost 49% at 48.5. And it's once that happens, I mean, once teams are just nailing the threes on them, which has been a huge issue all season, you know, go back to Ryan Anderson if you don't believe me. But once they start hitting the threes, then it becomes like pump fake, and then you're just matadoring them in right at Marcin Gortat, who, you know, as we've seen this season, is kind of a statistical hound who's just blocking shots. And, you know, as we talked about before, kind of regressing a little bit this season. And that's, I mean, the perimeter defense can't be that bad when you have Luis Scola, Marcin Gortat, and Markieff Morris as your back line to protect the rim after you give up that mistake on the perimeter.
Yeah, you know, the thing with the perimeter defense, too, you know, sometimes it seems like they're having a problem with overhelping. Sometimes it seems like they're slow on rotations. You know, it's different stuff, but what's been absolutely consistent is that they're just getting torched every game. So it's not like a case where a couple teams just kind of blew up against us or some guys had, you know, amazing nights. You know, all these shots are wide open, and you have to think that the opposition at this point is game planning that, you know, this is how to beat the Suns, that they're going to give you these open shots. If, you know, you're patient, you make the passes, that you're going to get wide open looks and you're going to be able to take advantage of them. You know, the Suns haven't shown any ability to consistently defend the three-point line. And so I don't know whether it's something with scheme in there or the personnel. You know, a lot of the defenders, I mean, part of it's having the horses to run the race, and, you know, it's not like they have the best individual collection of talent defensively.
Yeah, and that's kind of a tough thing, because when you look at it, they don't have the best collection of talent, but, I mean, they have some talent there. I mean, Jared Dudley is widely known as one of the better help defenders in the league. Well, maybe not the league. Let's go ahead and say one of the better help defenders on this team, because he's very vocal. He moves around. He's active on defense. He sees things better than a lot of the guys on the team, which is not saying much, but he is a good help defender. Goran Dragic is athletic. He's long. He's big. Extremely quick. obviously he has the quick hands and he has the instincts. He had two steals for 10 straight games, and he's one of the better thieves in the league in general. So they have the tools out there on the defense on the perimeter, but it just feels like the meshing, and I think that's what you were saying there too, is just the unit as a group is not necessarily meshing together. I think they have a few individual tools. You know, we've talked about PJ Tucker, and so has everyone at nauseam, how good he's been defensively. I mean, he gets a hand in the face and bodies and fights against guys like LeBron and Carmelo, and they hit their tough shots, but every shot is a tough shot. They have a few good defenders. Jermaine O'Neal can't be scored all game. So if he was about 7 years younger, I would say that Marcin Gortat probably wouldn't see much action, because Jermaine O'Neal's he harnesses 7 years ago Jermaine O'Neal for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then he ends up getting one of those war veteran injuries to kind of come up with his hamstring or his knee after playing extended minutes. So it's tough on him. Overall, the collection of talent's not there. One of the big things, too, is the rotations, and that happened in the Toronto game where Pietrus nailed a three that was kind of the death nail for the team, and they ran that play about four or five times in a row, and it was Jared Dudley, ironically, as you talked about being kind of a slower guy. It was him not getting back to the corner, Pietrus knocking down the three, and then the Raptors don't score for three more minutes of game action, and that ends up being the difference in them winning the game.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's a situation where the scheme is making the talent look worse or things are snowballing. But really, I mean, if I'm going down the list and I'm looking at the defensive players, you know, individually, just there are too many guys that are either bad defenders like Beasley or slow like Dudley or slow and bad like Scola, which is, you know, just the perfect combination, to actually, you know, be able to put this together and defend well. You know, even players like Gortat, who was basically the best defender on the team last year in terms of points allowed per opponent field goal, is now, you know, much worse this year suddenly. And so is that a product of some of this other stuff with the rotations? You know, Morris, Brown. I mean, Brown has the tools to be a good defender, but he makes too many mental mistakes out there. I mean, you can't depend on him to be accountable. And so I don't know whether, like you're saying, that there is some chemistry, some cohesion, and things are going to meld together a little bit as things go on, or whether we just have a complete failure in terms of the plan being implemented that's sabotaging us.
Yeah, and when you're not good as a group, or rather, I should say, when you're not good individually as defenders, so it makes the group as a whole look bad, usually coaches turn to a gimmick. They turn to a 2-3 zone, a box and one, a full court press to kind of get you guys a little more frenetic and out of your rhythm as a team. This team doesn't really have the personnel to go full court all game. We've mentioned a few of the issues with the bigs, and those guys are not going to be able to play all, you know, the entire court for long periods of time. And Goran Dragic already does that all game, and by the third quarter, he needs to sit there with an oxygen machine, and the trainer's rubbing his shoulders, and he looks like a boxer after the 12th round of a heavyweight fight because he just looks like he's exhausted. So, I mean, do you feel they could go schematic? I mean, do they need to go and pull out a gimmick like a 2-3 zone or a box and one or just something to where they can kind of mask their inefficiencies on the defensive end?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, at this point in the year, you know, you eventually get to the point where you got to say, well, it's either talent and we're just not talented enough, or it's scheme. And, you know, for them to be this bad, I mean, I think something has to be schematically wrong. You know, part of the problem they have there, too, you know, you got guys like Tucker and Telfair that I think are the energy guys that can go out there, you know, at least for spells and play, you know, more of that tenacious defense. And I think guys like that would do well in the zone. But then you're sacrificing offense for defense because, unfortunately, on the team, most of the better defenders aren't the better offensive players. You have guys like Shannon Brown and, you know, Beasley, jacking up inefficient shots, and some of these guys that are scoring more of the points, you know, Scola's in double digits, and then the guys that are actually committed more on the defensive end, it seems, you know, you lose that aspect. So it's kind of, you know, like a double-edged sword there. You know, I think they got to try something different. You know, whether it's a zone, whether they just stop packing the lane and just make it a point, and, you know, we'd rather give you a layup than a three-point shot. You know, something has to change. If they keep down this course all year, it's just not going to work.
You kind of mentioned a word that we were talking about before the Portland game, which has changed there a few times. when you look at what's going on, they just made changes a handful of games ago. And what's funny is, since they made the changes, if you just forget how bad the last three games on the road have been, they're actually 3-4 since the changes. They haven't been terrible. They've just lost three in a row. So, you only look at what just happened. It's revisionist history. You go, oh, this just happened, and the wins came a long time ago, it feels like. The wins feel like they came last season. But they've actually been decent since the last changes. Does Gentry got to play like a hockey coach, and does he have to tweak things around and pretend, or even like a baseball coach, and go, hey, we're batting a right-handed team, we need to switch up the starting lineup and just not commit to a certain five to start a game? I mean, does he need to make some more changes, whether it be in the rotation, the minutes? Do new changes need to happen already?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to go through the second set and you start shuffling pieces around, and at some point you get to where you're just straightening picture frames in a burning house. Gentry's had success with tinkering with the rotation, but the problem in recent years is it's been that the team started off slow. By around mid-season or so, then Gentry kind of figured out some stuff that would work, then the team kind of finished strong, then we had some kind of late season injury that probably wouldn't have been too big to a legitimate contender but was crippling to a team fighting for the eighth seed, and then we get the 13th pick in the draft. And, that's been, kind of the what's been repeating for the last couple seasons. Like you had said, it hasn't been that long, and they've been on the road. And, the problem is, in the NBA, teams play much better at home. So even a bad team in the NBA is still hard to beat, on their court. And you also have the dynamic where, role players, guys like Tucker especially, those guys tend to play a lot better at home. It seems like they feed off the crowd. But, I think he's got to start looking at individual matchups and playing against teams like that. Sticking with just one five-man unit obviously isn't what he's looking at doing. Scola and Dudley moving to the bench, especially like a veteran like Luis Scola, I'm sure he wasn't happy about the demotion. So, eventually I think you kind of get to where you're shaking the team's confidence with too much change. But really, besides Dragic, I don't know if I think anybody's role is completely cemented or safe on the team.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I almost want, at some point, you got to be innovative. And LeBron James, there's an interview in ESPN, the magazine, they did the whole interview issue recently. And LeBron James, the main thing that stood out was one of the last questions he was asked, which was, you guys are a positionless team. You don't necessarily have a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 at any point in time, let alone with the starting lineup. Is that an evolution of basketball? Do you see it to the point where you're going to start seeing 6, 7 guys at power forward and 6, 8 guys at center, and it's just all ball handlers and shooters, and there's really no bigs? And he said, hey, if it's good for basketball, I'm glad to be part of that change. And I'm wondering with Alvin Gentry if he needs to be innovative and just kind of just throw the rule book to the side, take the team into the corner and go, hey, guys, guess what? You're a bad team. Hey, bad teams win at home. You're right. They're 5-3, but they're 2-8 on the road, which kind of gives you a real snapshot of how good this team is, and goes, hey, we're throwing the rule book out of there. Goran is our guy. He's performing. You guys can all admit that. He's the only consistent guy on the team outside of, old man O'Neal over there, who's playing amazing but can't play all the time. We're going to go ahead and just run with the hot hand, as they say in the NFL, we're going to run with the hot hand every game going forward. Brown, you may start some games at shooting guard. Dudley, you may start some games at shooting guard. Beasley, you may start. I think that might be an interesting thing to do, especially if he knows that he's a lame duck coach. I don't feel like they're going to bring him back in the offseason. And I know we've talked about this before, about the whole, are they going to fire guys and that kind of a change. But I wonder if that would be an interesting move to make, because if he's right and it works, then he's got another job somewhere else and someone's going to love what he did. If it doesn't work, then this team is already what they are. They're already right now 7-11 and they're not a good basketball team. So I'm wondering if he needs to get innovative, make some changes, do some different things. And that would be, the confidence may shake. These guys are professionals though. He needs to be able to pull them in the corner and go, you still cash a $6 million check this year, Beasley. I'm going to start you at the 4, at the 3, and bring you off the bench at times. It's just what's going to happen. We're going to change things around and we're going to be a different kind of team.
Yeah, and if he needs to do that, Gentry, is a player's coach. He works well with the players, and so I think he's uniquely suited to where, he does have a little bit more leverage with, moving guys in and out of the starting lineup, and I think he could do that with Beasley, once you get to a certain point without, it resulting in him, moping and pouting and throwing away any possible contribution he could make. You know, other than that, you know, with Gentry's role, you know, we're still early in the season, but we're almost a quarter of the way through now. But I mean, you kind of have to wonder, you know, Turner's role, what he's done for this team. You know, they've just, you know, slid down this slope defensively the last couple of years. You know, there hasn't been, you know, there's been, you know, it's devolved instead of evolving instead of something better. And then, you know, possibly, you know, if it's at this point at the trade deadline, you wonder if something will happen there. And, you know, maybe they look at just acquiring some kind of guys that can actually defend the perimeter a little bit and, you know, go at it from that aspect.
Yeah, and it's funny because the proposed trade, not anything real, by the way, it's just one of those fake articles of, hey, interesting trades, was, you know, would the Suns and the Celtics entertain Jeff Green, terrible contract, and Avery Bradley for Marcin Gortat? You know, it solves some of Boston's woes, and it gives the Suns, you know, Avery Bradley, a young gun that could be a really, really good player, or at worst is just going to be another defensive guy that comes out and dominates games on that end of the floor. And you know what? At the very beginning, everyone said, you know, Marcin Gortat's too good for that, or maybe Avery Bradley's too good for that. And, you know, oh, there's not a spot for Avery Bradley on the floor with this Suns team. I think if Avery Bradley was on this team, there'd only be one guard that plays more than him, and that'd be Goran Dragic, because Avery Bradley is, when you look at it now, he's better than everything they got at the backup one and at the two position, their entire depth chart. So, you know, those kind of things could happen at the trade deadline where the team may fire sale. They haven't done it in a long time, which is why they're drafting 13 every year. But we had talked a little bit about this before with the Suns coaching staff. So let's talk about changes here for just a couple of minutes before we jump into the next thing. With changes, do the Suns, A, benefit from a change during the season? And B, would the change be more than Alvin Gentry, in your opinion?
You know, to touch on the last thing first, you know, I'm going to say, regardless of whether this turns into a burning boat, I don't see Gortat being a Phoenix Sun past the trade deadline this year. But as far as the coaches go, you know, the first thing, I don't know where the ties exactly come in, but it seems like the first easy fire to make, the change to make, would be Turner. I can't imagine that there's anybody in the league that's doing a worse job than him from a coaching standpoint based on results. You know, his job as a defensive coach, and the Suns play the worst defense in the NBA. So, you know, accountability going to the top, you know, first it passes through him from the players to Turner. You know, I don't think that a midseason change is really going to do a whole lot of good with Gentry. I don't think that, you know, somebody's sitting by the phone waiting for the Suns to call. So either way, you might as well ride this out and see how it works this year, see what he can do, and then make that decision later. And, you know, the same thing with the front office. You know, I can't imagine that that they're too comfortable in, you know, their prospects of, you know, inking new contracts this summer at the end of this year with the Suns.
Yeah, and with Gentry, I want to make sure, I've said this numerous times, and a lot of people disagree with me, and the handful agree with me. I've been around Alvin Gentry for about 2.5 years as far as covering the Suns and watching from close and afar. I really like the guy. I think he's a really good coach. I think he's a really good teacher. I think the player-coach aspect is something that you have to have nowadays to be a great coach. When you look at Eric Spoelstra winning championships, you see Scottie Brooks with a good young team, you see Monty Williams with the New Orleans Hornets. A lot of people regard him as one of the better young coaches. So you have to be a player's coach in this league nowadays, it feels like, with the way players are coddled from the age of 12. Once they can bounce a ball, they're a phenom, so they need to be coddled. Player coaches are important, and I think Alvin Gentry is one of the better ones at it. If you're gonna give someone the bulk of the blame for the season, you're right. I mean, it's Elson Turner, but how often in the NBA do you see a team that struggles and they just turn around and go, hey, you know what, we're pretty terrible defensively, we're gonna go ahead and let go the guy who's responsible for the defense? That doesn't happen very often, but it's something that you probably should see more often, because all the team sometimes needs is a little bit of a shakeup. And most of the time it's the head coach, and the head coach usually doesn't deserve all the blame. But if you know, if someone's got to get the blame, I mean, 30th ranked defense out of 30 teams, there's really no argument for Elson Turner doing his job this year. And the pieces aren't there necessarily, but the mark of a coach is showing progression. And this team has regressed defensively as you go through the course of the season so far, at least in my opinion. The team has not gotten better as the season has progressed on the defensive end.
Yeah, you know, I think with that, I mean, you know, something along those lines might make sense. you know, with Gentry, you know, unfortunately for him, fortunately, whatever your opinion is on his coaching ability, you know, even if you're getting stuck, getting dealt crap hands, you know, eventually, you know, you still run out of chips playing with those. And so some, you know, eventually, you know, regardless of whether it's his fault or not, the team underperforms, then it, you know, the blame goes on the coach. Now, Turner seems like the easy mark, because if the front office is the one buying the groceries and they're asking, you know, these head coaches to cook the meal, then what's easier for the front office to say, you know, I guess we just got you crap defensive talent. You know, these guys just suck and this is all our fault. Or is it easier for them to say, hey, Turner, you're not coaching these guys right, because, you know, as Babby said, you know, this team is more talented than last year's team. So you're doing more with less. So that seems like he would be, you know, a really easy mark to kind of redirect some of the pressure off of them for the failings of the team.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that sentiment. I'm just, my argument is that doesn't happen enough in the NBA. There's not a history of that to where assistant coaches get fired when teams are struggling. It happens a lot in other sports. And, you know, hitting coach gets fired in baseball, or a D coordinator gets fired in the NFL, and it lights a fire, and the team either improves or they, you know, prove that the players weren't very good and bring in a new coach and kind of change things. So, hey, you know what? If that happens with the Phoenix Suns, I wouldn't argue with them. I don't think Elson Turner is not doing his job. You just don't see it happen enough in the NBA to feel confident going, yeah, they're going to actually take the guy who deserves the blame and blame him instead of actually just firing the head coach, because that's just usually what teams do. My gut says that they just ride it out with everybody to the end of the season, and nobody has contracts going into next season anyway, so they either ride it out to the end and bring everyone back, as we have talked about before, you know, just bring them all back and see what they can do, or they're just going to clean house and hope maybe a Brian Shaw or one of the Van Gundys or somebody interesting wants to come over here and coach the team and fix them, and we'll see how that works. I like Gentry. Turner is the mark. He's the guy who should go if they're going to fire somebody. But, you know, the chips are not there. And one of the biggest things with the chips not being there is something you mentioned to me that I hadn't even thought of all season. And that's that this team's high score for the year is 26 points from Goran Dragic. That's right, right?
Yeah, 26 points. I think it was on November 9th. Goran had 26 points. And, yeah, that is the highest individual output by a Phoenix Sun this season, 18 games in.
Yeah, that's remarkable. As far as the points scored and the lack of, obviously we knew this team didn't have a go-to guy. We just figured that Beasley and Dragic were going to combine for probably 50 shots a game, and they were going to ride those two guys out to wins. And instead, they've kind of balanced the load out amongst everybody and just play at a slower pace. What's your take on this team with having a top flight score? And I mean, can anyone on this team even score 30?
So, I mean, we kind of had a little bit of a running discussion on it last year, you know, kind of an over-under on games it would take for somebody to score 30 last year, because they didn't have the top flight score then either. And, you know, I'd say maybe like 27 games is where I'd put that this year. You know, we're 18 games in, and, you know, 26 points is still 4 points below that, so nobody's even, you know, gotten within a shot to where, you know, they could have just missed it. And really, I mean, if you look at it up and down the lineup, there aren't a whole lot of guys, you know, really even capable of scoring 30. I mean, I guess Brown could explode. I think Dudley scored 30 at least a couple times. But Dragic and Beasley were the guys that you kind of thought that would give them that kind of scoring punch. And right now, Dragic is leading the team with 15.3 points, and that's the lowest average, leading average on a team for anybody in the NBA besides the Timberwolves, and they have Love, who's averaging like 21.7, and he just doesn't have enough games to qualify. Cleveland, who has Kyrie Irving, who's averaging, I think, 22.4, once again, without enough games to qualify, and the Wizards. So basically, the only team that the Suns have a better individual scorer than is the Wizards.
We know a little bit about the Wizards this year. I think they finally won a game. So, and that's not a conversation you want to... Anytime you're lumped into a statistical category with the Washington Wizards this year, or really any year over the past 5 to 6, you're probably not in good conversational mode there. So you say 26.5 games on the season overall, not 27.5 from today. So you're basically putting the mile marker on Sunday, December 23rd at home against the Clippers would be the 27th game of the season. So the over-under would pretty much be on that game. That's right around the time you think someone's got to score 30. Who's your money on to score 30?
Yeah, I would say it's probably going to be Dragic at this point. You know, Beasley was the guy that I think that, you know, the front office or whoever was ultimately responsible for, you know, his signing, it seems like those guys aren't necessarily always completely on the same page with each other regarding personnel moves. But, you know, in the 10-11 season when he played for the Wolves, you know, he averaged 19.6 boards, and he shot 45% from the field and 37% from three. Now, if he could do that this year, then he would at least, you know, somewhat make up for his defensive shortcomings, and he'd, you know, maybe be a small net positive for the team. But, you know, and in that same season, he hit over 26 or more 15 times that year. So, you know, he's the guy that could potentially score, but, you know, now you've seen him this year even, and he started off, and I think the first 11 games, he averaged 15 shots a game. And now he's been scaled back to where the last seven games, he's only averaging 8 shots a game. So his role has really diminished, you know, and his role in the offense. So, you know, it's come to the point where what is his role? Because if he's not there to score, and he sure as hell can't play defense, then, you know, what is the point of having Beasley out there, you know, to average 12 points, 4 rebounds, and be a sieve on defense? I'm not quite sure, you know, where they plan on getting that scoring punch from on his team.
For me to answer the first part of the question that I had asked you, you're going with Gorin, you're going with around the end of December mode, 27.5 game mark of the season is your over-under. I'm going to go with Kendall Marshall. I think he's going to do it, and he's going to do it in the D-League, but he'll probably be the first one to score 30, and I know that's going a little off-cuff. I mean, that's not with the actual Suns on the Suns roster, but, you know, he had 21 last night in his D-League debut, so why not? I mean, he'll be the guy that does it and scores 30 in the D-League and makes the Suns proud. And to switch over, I mean, realistically, I would say that it's going to be a closed-door meeting with Michael Beasley, and they're going to go, you're getting 30-plus shots tonight. I don't care where they come from, and you're going to do it. And I think Michael Beasley scores 30 sometime in December. I think if they go into January without a 30-point score, then they're probably going to end up having, you know, maybe 8 or 9 wins to end the month, and that's going to be the death nail of their season. So I think Beasley gets a closed-door conversation. He gets up 30-plus shots. It'll be an inefficient 30, and it may not be in a win, but it's going to be one of those statement games where he's pretty much told, go out there and be Michael Beasley from Kansas State. Don't be Michael Beasley from this season. Go out there and do what you need to do. And as far as his role on the team, I thought coming into the season, the best role for him was off the bench as a six-man scorer. I thought that the Shannon Brown role, what Shannon did at the beginning of the season, was the smartest role for Beasley, and then you start Brown and Dudley, little undersized on the perimeter and the wing, but I figured those guys would mesh better as far as an overall cohesive unit, and then you have Beasley as a gunner coming off of the bench, you know, and I figured that would be a smarter situation for him, pardon me. I thought that'd be a smarter situation for him, but they decided to go with him as a starter because they were just head over heels for the guy, you know, from day one when they signed him through training camp. So his role in the team, to me, is a guy that goes out there and starts and then heads to the bench and then gets a couple of minutes in with the second unit in the second quarter and then hits the bench and then starts the third quarter and then hits the bench. That's been his role all season, and unfortunately that's his role as of right now. He's just a starter on a bad team, and he's just a part of the offense when in reality he should be the center of the offense when you're a 7-11 club who's trending south right now.
Yeah, but part of that with where he's hitting the bench so many times is that, you know, the team's playing bad, and then as soon as he leaves the court, they start playing better. You know, as far as him being a six man, you know, that might not be a horrible role. You know, Gentry has his, you know, philosophies, his little maxims, like shoot the shot that's available to you, you know, aphorism, going with the hot hand. And, you know, if you chose to take that approach with Beasley, you can bring him in off the bench and you give him 4 or 5 quick shots. And, you know, if he makes 2 or 3 of them, then, you know, you let him keep going. And if not, then you tether him back in and, you know, keep him in that role. To me, it doesn't necessarily matter who starts, and it matters more about the minutes and generally who finishes. Part of that, though, is the team has just been horrible, you know, coming out the gate in a lot of these games recently. And even, you know, overall the season, their pattern has been, you know, dig a hole and then, you know, try to climb out of it. And that's just not a good strategy. I mean, if you continually put yourself down like that, the NBA, you know, it's a game of runs, and teams are going to go through sporadic play. You know, it's really hard to blow out a team like 40 by 40, like the Pistons did to us the other night. You know, generally, you know, even if a team gets up by 15, 20, the other team's got a run in them. They're going to cut that down to single digits. You know, but rarely do you see like what the Suns did earlier a couple times at home where they actually came back from those deficits. You know, they did the same thing on the road, and they've built those deficits, and they've never come back from one of them on the road.
Yeah, I mean, they've closed gaps, like we saw with the Knicks game, to talk about the most recently situation with that. They can close gaps, and I'll give them credit for that. As much as Gentry says, I don't want this to be the identity of the team, guess what it is? I mean, it flat out is. It's a team that gets down, whether it's early in the first or in the second or in the third or early in the fourth. They get down, and their second unit, their energy, their sense of urgency, whatever you want to call it, brings them back. They close the gap at the worst, and the Detroit game was probably the only game where they didn't really close the gap, and maybe the Orlando game where they just got just outclassed from the, you know, entry of the ball in the third quarter. But this team comes back, they close gaps, they very rarely win games from beginning to end. I shouldn't say very rarely, because actually three of their wins this season are beginning to end type wins. When you talk about the game against Detroit earlier in the year, the game against Portland at home, and the game against Cleveland on the road, those were games that were fairly wire to wire that they won. And the rest of their games this season have been they had to come back, or they found a double-digit deficit in pretty much every single game this season. And so we're not running too long on the listeners out there. We don't want to brutalize you for too long. Let's look at the week ahead real quick. Tonight they're playing Memphis, and this podcast is more than likely going to be up tomorrow. So quick preview or prediction for you on the Memphis game, and we'll see if you're right tomorrow. And then let's go ahead and preview the week coming up for the Suns.
The Memphis game is pretty easy to, you know, do the preview for. That's just going to be a loss. It's going to be probably pitiful, pathetic. I don't think the Suns can stay close with them tonight.
Yeah, I don't think so either. It's on the road against arguably the best team in the league right now. Records don't mean much at this point. The Heat they're the best team in the league, but Memphis is proving that they belong in that conversation. They're what the Suns want to be. They're no better at the one position than they are the 2, 3, 4, 5 position. Their bench is good. They knock down threes. They play defense. They're exactly what the Suns described themselves at the beginning of the season. Talented, deep, good 1 through 5, you know, not one quote-unquote best player, and they just play and beat teams because they're even all the way throughout the court. And then we switch over to Thursday. They come home finally after being on the road for 11 total days and playing 6 games. They come home to play Dallas, back out on the road to play the Clippers before coming home to end the week on Sunday against Orlando. Let's talk about that Dallas game quick for a second. We're going to bring back the little candor from earlier about money back. Let's talk about that Dallas game for a second.
Yeah, you know, that's a game that they can win. You know, Dallas so far this season has been, you know, fairly comparable. I think they're right at 500 right now. So that's a winnable game, and you have to think that there's going to be a little special emphasis put on these guys, you know, based on the stakes of the game. You know, the Suns had that old TNT curse that had went on a couple years back with consecutive losses, but you'd really hope that they don't lay an egg there, although a part of me, you know, like a sinister side, kind of hopes that this whole gimmick kind of blows up spectacularly in the front office's face, and that the Mavericks just come out and, like, skull drag the team, and it turns into, like, another Piston-esque bloodbath. And the TNT announcers are just yucking it up and make, you know, like not less than 14 references in the second half to how the Suns are going to be refunding a whole boatload of tickets.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is I'm looking at the ticket availability, and there's 900. I'm not, you know, pimping out Suns tickets here, but there's 980 Suns tickets still available, as low as $9. And, you know, if you're going to go down there and pay $10 for a beer and then go back to the ticketer and get your money back, I mean, I don't think anyone should do that. I think if the game is a good game, you should play by the honor code, but I don't think people will. It's an interesting promotion. It could easily fire back in their face. I mean, if this team doesn't get up for that game, you say Dallas is a winnable game. How winnable was that Detroit game, and how winnable was that Toronto game? I mean, that's kind of the course of the season so far. They're barely squeaking by teams that are at the bottom of the league. They're battling with teams that are at the middle to, you know, almost bottom of the league, and getting stomped by teams that are in that upper echelon. So it's one of those games where, you know, Dallas is in that middle pack right now. They started off strong. They're average right now, but they could easily pull out an OJ Mayo performance that the Suns wish was a Michael Beasley performance and end up losing the game. Same could be said for the Clippers. Same could be said for the Magic. And then you look at the rest of this schedule here in December, and this stretch might define this team. This stretch might define a lot of people's jobs, might define their trade market value when it comes down to the All-Star game and the trade deadline. A lot of interesting things coming up in the next handful of games and the rest of this month as far as if this team is successful and if they're not successful.
Yeah, the stretch right now is where they need to capitalize. A couple of those road losses just really, they were really painful. They set the team back. I don't like the press from the Dallas promotion. You know, I guess any press is good press. The team got some notoriety, but it's not the kind of press I want to get. Kind of, you know, makes me feel ashamed of the team. It just seems desperate a little bit, but maybe that's just me. You know, looking forward, though, the December schedule is actually still kind of easy because in January there's a very good possibility that the Suns might only have one game the whole month against a team with a losing record. You know, so far the Suns haven't beat a team with a winning record. Their signature win, I guess you could call it, was against Denver, who's 9-9, and they're 0-6 against teams with winning records, and which actually means that they've played 12 teams with, you know, 500 or below, and they're only 7-11 so far. So, you know, this week I think a good goal would be 2-2. You know, and that's winning the games that they're supposed to. You know, it's just hard to see them beating, especially Memphis or the Clippers on the road. So that's what I would say would be a good week for them. 2-2, kind of stop the bleeding from the road trip, and you know, try to turn things in the right direction again.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that sentiment until I saw the Detroit and the Toronto game, and now I don't look at records of opponents. I look at personnel and go, yeah, that team can probably get up by 20 on the Suns if they come out half asleep, and if it's on the road, well, they're going to lose that one. If they fall behind, if it's at home, well, maybe they'll storm back and make me look stupid for walking down the corridor back to the media room with 2 minutes to go when they're down by 13 and they come back and tie it. There you go. I mean, the week coming up, that's the games that we got. You know, they play on Thursday, they play on Saturday, they play on Sunday after this game against Memphis tonight. This podcast, like I said, probably going to be up tomorrow. Parting thoughts from you, Jim, before we send off our listeners to go ahead and enjoy the rest of their day?
Yeah, the Suns, you know, aren't a talented, you know, overly talented team. They've only got two guys on the team, I think, Dragic and Gortat, that are even average starters in the league. So it's going to be hard for them to put a starting five that's going to match anybody. That's maybe part of why they have done better with the reserves on the court, because they're deep, but they're not strong up front. But, you know, I just hope that they show effort through this week. I hope the guys don't quit on the team. The Pistons game was just really brutal. It was embarrassing. And, you know, I don't want to see any more efforts like that coming up.
And you know what? I should continue calling you Mr. Brightside, because at least in this one moment, this one topic, you are the positive force of this podcast. You say they're going to go 2-2 this week. I'm not that optimistic. I think this team is in a mirror right now. They're falling down, and I honestly can see an 0-4 week with this week. I mean, Orlando took care of business against them on the road, or rather at home. They play good against good teams. They don't play good against bad teams, so I hope it doesn't happen, but I unfortunately see an 0-4 week, and I see some long faces here once we get home and we get down the stretch in December. All right, well, look, we'll be back again next week. We'll be talking more Suns. Check out Jim on Bright Side of the Sun, as you'll pick up this podcast there, and check out me on SB Nation Arizona page. I can talk right now. It's been a long night. Everybody have a good rest of your night. Talk to you later, Jim.
All right, I'll see you next week. We can go back over your erroneous prediction.
All right, thanks. We'll talk to you guys later.